Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Mayor Tom Menino was scheduled to be in studio today. He had to cancel because of the school bus driver strike, so we'll discuss that strike and the public's view of unions in 2013. Then we'll focus on something else which upsets the mayor, pit bulls. There was a pit bull ordinance in Boston which was overturned late last year when the state banned breed-specific local regulations. And now the Globe reports they're big in the suburbs and asks, are pit bulls to be loved or feared?
Then continuing our interview with candidates for the Democratic nomination for governor, state treasurer Steve Grossman joins us. Then the Frontline special airing tonight on how concussions have devastated thousands of NFL players while the NFL denied and denied. Plus, every time did you eat one of those juicy-looking beach plums you found out on the trail? Well, everything you need to know about foraging for food is brought to us by our new foraging enthusiast, Edgar B. Herwick III.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hello there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
You know, before we get started, it appears I caused panic yesterday, Marjorie, during our discussion of all women's colleges. I inadvertently said that Mount Holyoke was about to join the ranks of co-ed schools. And based on the volume of the response we got in the last, I don't know, 20 hours, we may be the most popular show with the alum of Mount Holyoke. So my apologies to all. They are all women, and they are staying
good.
I'm so glad. Now to the news. You know, Mayor Menino is going to join us in studio today to talk about his legacy, the job that awaits the next mayor, and the reason he isn't here, obviously, is because he's being mayoral, dealing with the school bus strike. At least the last time that people talked about Boston's busing crisis, I think we can agree the situation was a bit more dire. This morning, there's a surprise strike by the union which represents Boston school bus drivers that halted service for more than 30,000 kids. Only 30 of the school system's 650 buses were on the road. And as you read and heard just a minute ago, drivers have a list of grievances, including changes in their health care, payroll problems, new work procedures, which include GPSs on the buses, which they're not crazy about. And Tom Menino's response is he's equally peeved, if not more, by the pop-up strike. But the question for you all here at 877-301-8970, one, where are you on this? Are parents and kids the only ones paying the price? But a corollary thing that Marjorie and I were talking about, has it become too easy to disparage public and quasi-public employees? And when did the public turn on public and this is actually a private sector union, but public and quasi-public employees unions, the animus that I have heard. By the way, I'm not defending a wildcat strike that puts single parents in horrible shape, causes kids not to be able to get to school. But the animus in general, Marjorie, that is directed at almost anybody who is in the public sector, the anger at the police over their 25.4% increase. By the way, they didn't give it to themselves. An arbitrator under law gave it to them over 6 years. No one's angry at the arbitrator. Yeah. Everybody's angry,
Jim,
at the cops.
Here's where it comes from. Just a couple of weeks ago, we talked about, you know, millions of women in America fearing they're going to end up as bag ladies collecting cans in their old age because they don't have a pension.
That.
And you thought that was shocking. That's where it comes from. I think it's dawned on people that worked in the private sector. They don't have a pension, or their pension is so measly they can't survive. They're hoping Obamacare is going to pay for their health care in their old age because Medicare not going to have enough for Plan B or to fill the donut hole or whatever it is. It's fear. It's the contrast between people in the private sector's lack of retirement and the people.
So we're angry at them.
We're
because
jealous.
They're doing better than we are. That's a good basis for anger. Maybe it should be, let's try to raise all boats, as the saying goes.
It's not just that. It's not just that. I think in towns across Massachusetts, you are constantly asked to raise your taxes, and usually you're asked to raise your taxes for the schools.
It's actually fairly infrequent, but go ahead.
And I think it's a very difficult thing for people to say, okay, I'm going to have to, the taxes are quite high, property taxes in Massachusetts, I'm going to have to be paying more and more to fund the retirements and the pensions and the health care. when I don't have retirement, a pension, and healthcare myself. So it's jealousy. I'm one of those people that fears becoming a bag lady, Jim, and I worry about it all night long.
877-301-8970. If you want to speak specifically about this school bus driver strike, and there was no notice, and it's pretty hard to defend. And by the way, the union itself was not even speaking to reporters. They handed out their National Labor Relations Board complaint against the bus company, which they work for. I don't even know what's going on with that, but you don't abandon these kids with no notice. It's insane. But I want to step back. And if you want to comment on that, it's fine, particularly if you're a parent whose kid was abandoned this morning. And good for the cops and the MBTA, which is giving free rides, thanks to the mayor, to kids who have student ID. But it really is an opportunity.
The notion
that you're expressing, because private sector people are not doing as well, that's a reason, as the expression goes, to hate on public.
It's not just that. I think that, originally, teachers, for example, were paid horribly. Cops were paid horribly. Firefighters were paid horribly. The idea was, okay, you have these wonderful, generous benefits because we're making up for the really poor salaries you have. That's changed. People aren't paid horribly anymore. They're paid pretty well. Cops in Boston, this is the fight over the contract where they want a 25% raise over 6 years.
Excuse me, they were awarded a 25.4% raise over six years.
That's right. They wanted 25% over 3 years. Forgive me, I made
a mistake. Whatever it was, but that's what was awarded.
Actually, they wanted
21%
over 3 years. Well, I don't think the arbitrators are so impartial because they always seem to agree.
Then the city or the state should then vitiate the law.
Let me finish my point. When you're talking about an average salary for police officers in Boston of $110,000, and that's considering overtime and so forth, to most people, that's not a bad piece of change. And you can also retire early in a lot of these public sector unions. I mean,
How did the cops negotiate? With whom?
They negotiated with Tom Menino.
So why are people not angry at Tom Menino about it? Why are they not angry at local school committees and local selectmen?
It has dawned on people post the recession that while they are asked to pay more in their taxes to fund these different public sector unions, they themselves are barely holding on and they're scared to death.
But you didn't answer my question.
What?
The only way these unions that people now love to hate in the public and quasi-public sector got this money was because some likely elected official, a school committee, a board of aldermen, a mayor, agreed to it.
Well,
why is the anger not directed at the men and women who said yes rather than the people who are just trying to defend themselves?
We'll see what happens in the mayoral election in Boston because Marty Walsh is very much associated with unions. And interestingly, I think people do draw a distinction between the trade unions and the public employee unions. So, he's closing in on John Conley. He may not be hurt by it. But I think that we'll see how much the union association hurts Marty Walsh in this race versus John Conley, who's associated with education. You ask the one word to describe college, people say schools. The one word to describe Marty Walsh is unions. We'll see if that matters. But I think it's post-recession where people are working longer, they're working harder, they're not getting raises, and they're looking at the people in their towns that work for the public, the cities and towns, getting raises and having health care that's pretty much assured.
Right, who make sure they're safe and teach their kids and make sure their houses don't burn down.
Here's an idea that I think would make a lot of people less upset about this kind of thing. Okay, you can retire at 50, but you can't collect your pension until you're 65.
I'm fine with that. You've argued every time Deval Patrick comes in here, you've made the same case. And he did move a little bit on this.
That's not the deal, is it? You retire at 50, you start collecting your pension.
He did it at the MBTA, didn't he?
What he did at the MBTA, if people don't know this, this was an unbelievable deal. This one really drove me crazy. You could go to work for the MBTA at 20 or 21, and you could retire after 20 years at 40 or 41 with a full pension and full health care. And what would happen is you would then go on to work for another job in the state of Massachusetts. So you're collecting.
The head of the Convention Center Authority, who's a wonderful guy whom we both like, Jim Rooney, did exactly that, actually.
Our number is 877-301-8970. 7301-8970. My theory is a lot of this has to do with the fear of becoming a bag lady, that if you're in the private sector, you're really worried that no one's going to employ you at 75. Maybe you can be I don't know what you can do at 75 or 80, and people are living there to their 80s now. Many people in the private sector, it's not like it used to be where you retire from General Motors or you retire from – look at the woman that called up last week that worked for Lehman Brothers and had worked for Lehman Brothers all those years, was expecting a pension of $2,500 a month. They get in their financial mess. What was her pension? She said it was something like $500 a month or something like that.
What was the former head? What was his name? Richard Fold? Was that who
it
was?
Yes, who had seven houses or some crazy thing and had loads of money. I think that's what's happened. It's dawned on private sector workers that the pendulum has swung not from the public employees with these very, very very modest salaries and great benefits, but with public employees with comparable salaries and great benefits.
What's the average pension for a state employee in Massachusetts?
I do not believe
so when the governor has told us this in studio, I think the governor's making it up?
I think he is just incorrect. I
think low 20s is what he's told us.
I don't buy that for one
877-301-897. You know what the problem is here, and then we will get to the calls. It's sort of it's misdirected, what you call jealousy, anger, that sort of thing. You know what it's analogous to? It's analogous to everybody gets upset with the welfare recipient who's in the front page of the Herald, for example. Wait, let me finish. But no one is upset at the corporate welfare recipient who's taking tens and tens of millions of dollars.
I think that's totally different. You know,
how's it different?
Because I mean, I am not upset with poor people that are in desperate straits that go out and get EBT cards. I disagree with my paper's kind of fixation on this. I mean, I am much more upset with the people that are running Lehman Brothers and Goldman Sachs.
You think you're the norm or not? I don't think so.
Well, I think again, I think you know we are lucky. We are in the middle class. I think if you are a poor person and the person next to you is ripping off the system and you're just barely getting by, that's what fuels that kind of anger. But I think it's analogous to what fuels the anger now of middle class people who are worrying about slipping into poverty in their old age.
What if it turns out, let me ask you something. Well, I am surely not defending this no-notice strike. What if it turns out you read follow-up stories tomorrow to show that the union is totally correct, that their work rules were changed unilaterally, that their health benefits were changed unilaterally, all these things. What if it turns out that all their complaints are legitimate? Even if you don't support the action they took, would you support them?
Well, it's not looking good for the bus drivers at this point because apparently they're upset about the GPS devices
that
would
enable
parents to know where they are so that when they're standing out in the street corner for 20 minutes in February wondering, where's the bus, they have an idea if the bus is showing up or if it's just two blocks away or if it's not coming for a half an hour. You know, especially in Boston, we have so many single mothers who need their jobs and need to get to work. Look at the situation they're in today because these bus drivers, they have their kids at home. You hope they have bosses that are sympathetic to their plight and say, okay, it's fine.
Horrible. I
agree.
But
these mothers may not even get paid today if they're not in a job where you do need a union, and there are many jobs you really need unions in. I mean, the hotel workers, those kinds of people, people that are really struggling.
Can I ask you a question before we get to the calls?
What?
Should we leave – well, we can't now. They're all full. But in the future, should we leave one line open for one of your cousins who retired at 42 from the public sector?
Well,
or should they just fight to get
well,
in?
Jim knows. This is what really drives me crazy is my whole family's retired.
Right, exactly. 877-301-8970. And wonderful people, I should say. Sarah Newton, you've been very patient. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for the call. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, good afternoon. I just think it really started with Reagan when he busted up all the unions. It was like the first start of it. And
the PATCO,
the air traffic controllers.
Yeah,
he fired them all.
Back in 81 or 83 or whenever that was.
Exactly. And he totally backed management and they fell in lockstep with that. And what happened was, the people who were in the private sector who, you know, thought, hey, I'm not going to drive a bus. I'm going to work in an office and I'm going to be a big shot. All of a sudden, the CEOs are stealing their pension and stealing everything and, you know, slicing and dicing. And now they look at the bus driver who's like, how come you get a retirement plan and I don't?
That's
and
right.
I think
it's
that's
jealousy.
Where the jealousy comes in. And it's kind of like, you know, you thought you were getting this big grand, you know, golden parachute, and the people who took the money are the people like Bain Capital.
Sarah, I think you said it beautifully. Sarah, thanks for the call. And for those who don't know, not only were the air traffic controllers unilaterally fired by President Reagan, which did, I think, give birth to this whole new attitude, but also as someone, as Marjorie knows, I was the former president of a union that represented legal services, lawyers, secretaries, and paralegals around the country when Reagan was president, and it still exists, I should say, is a new way of bargaining also came in, which is in prior years, a union had negotiated X in their contract, and the next contract was, here's what we'd like in addition X, and the employer generally worked out something in between, but that was the era of the give back, which also change this notion that employers come to the table and ask unions to take far less than they're already existing on. Well, their salaries and benefits, they of the employers, are skyrocketing. What's so funny?
Stephen just sent us an email. He comments on the fact that you just said the average pension is $26,000.
No, I didn't say it. The governor said it. $23,000.
I do not believe that's correct. But anyway, Stephen says, the average pension may be $20,000, but the average retiree in Massachusetts is collecting three of them all at the same time.
There may be some truth there, Stephen. Let's go to John and Hingham. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hello there, John.
Hi. I guess if the governor said that's the average pension. I'm going to take his word for it. He's got all the resources to back it up. But I would bet that those are that salary is for a selectman that retired with benefits for doing a part-time job.
No, actually, that's not. He's been asked specifically by Marjorie about 42 times. We've asked, what is the average pension of a state public employee?
But you know, other people disagree with that, like the Michael Widmer types and stuff like that.
Well, why don't you cite some? What does he say?
Because I don't have the numbers in front of me. They do think it's higher than that.
But you do acknowledge the governor said low 20s, correct?
He said 26,000. It went up. It went up during his term. It started at 20, went up to 26.
But John, I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
That's a great point, that you can go work for some of these towns and after 10 years be vested. Is that what you're talking about, John? Like the librarians and the selectmen and so? Well, not librarians. They deserve it. But the selectmen and elected officials, is that what you're talking about, John?
Exactly. People that basically attend a meeting once every other week or once a week and then get these tremendous opportunities, including health care and pensions, basically they signed up to do a volunteer job and they're getting benefits because...
Well, John, you'll be shocked. We have a horrible connection, so I got to let you go. As a former one of those people, I was a city councilor for one term in Cambridge, and Cambridge is one of the biggest cities in the state. It's got 100 and some thousand people. It's probably the third, fourth, fifth biggest city in the state. I agree with you. They should be part-time.
Don't you remember?
They should be part-time, and they should get part-time salaries. I made far too much. I mean, I just did. There's just it shouldn't pay what it does, and it shouldn't be as rich with benefits as it is.
Don't you remember the story about the couple, the husband and wife, there in one of the suburbs a few years ago? They were both went to a couple of meetings a year. And
oh,
they sued
I totally
for
do
unemployment benefits in there.
Well, there are, I mean, by the way, there are. I would say there's not 6 months that goes by where you don't read about some absolute abomination of someone bending but not technically breaking the rules. But you know what happens with that, and you're sensitive to this too. It trickles down to poison the well for the vast majority of people in the public sector who are not stealing, who are not manipulating the system, but are working hard, making decent wages.
I think very few people are stealing or scamming the system. I think the system has just the pendulum has swung, and it's no longer an issue of these really low wages for really great benefits. The wages have come up; they're comparable.
No, but you're picking some outlet. The average person working, for example, at One Ashburton Place is not making $100,000, Marjorie. They're at these state buildings and at local offices around the state. Working for Cambridge, the average person in an office in Cambridge City Hall or Brookline Town Hall is not making $110,000.
But the issue is when you can retire. And if you can retire after 20 years,
oh, I agree
20
with that.
Years
I agree with
or
that.
25 years and 30 years and have your 80% of your salary plus great health benefits sometimes for free and then go out and get another job. I mean, we've had this conversation about police officers all the time that have to retire very early. District attorneys can retire very early. It's fine if they want to retire early. You don't expect state troopers to be chasing people down the Mass Pike when they're 60, but they are not able to do jobs for the state police that are less physically challenging. Why are they retiring so early? And there's a whole classification of class four that includes a lot of lawyers that are in that same category. And district attorneys, by the way, are paid horribly when they're young, assistant DAs. But again, you can retire at a very early age.
But don't let that be a throwaway line. District attorneys, there's a story every year in the Globe or the Herald talking about the second and third jobs that people who are protecting as young ADAs, assistant district attorneys,
right. But they move
are
up
doing.
In the ranks.
I understand
they move
that.
Up in the ranks, and then they retire at 40.
What do you think Martha Coakley made as the Middlesex DA? I'm guessing what 120,000. I have no idea.
I don't know.
$120,000, is that exorbitant for the person who is the lead? Or what do you think Dan Conley makes in Boston? 110, 120.
No, but again, but you can retire very young, and then the taxpayers are asked to pay your full pension.
I understand.
And your full health care for another 40 years, Jim.
But again, if it turns out people consider that to be unfair, as you do, and I think there's a lot of what you say that has merit, then the question is, why is all the animus directed at the workers and their unions and none of it
directed at the men and women who agree to these things
in contract negotiations?
I think you're making an assumption that is not necessarily true. I think a lot of people are very upset with the agreements that their selectmen make or the agreements that their school committees make. I think a lot of people are very upset with Tom Menino because they think that he has not been tough enough on the firefighters and police unions in Boston. So we wind up with these situations where you have an average pay of $110,000.
That's why he's got 75% approval in Boston after 20. 20 years on the job.
Well,
historic
I think
highs.
A
They're
lot
really
of people love Tomanino. They may not think he's done a great job with the unions. I mean, we had this conversation during the Democratic convention when there was a big police action threatened right before the Democratic convention. And a lot of people complained.
Oh, you mean the one here with John Kerry in 2004.
Yes, that Menino caved to make sure that everything was all fine during the convention coming here. But one last point before we get back to the calls. One of the big things that people forget is you look at states that are really in serious trouble, like California, and it's coming across the country, as everything does, from west to east. One of the reasons they're in huge trouble is because they were very generous with pensions. And when people, and thank God we all do, or not all of us, but a lot of us live to 75, 80, 85, 90, they're very generous with pensions. And now they're broke because they cannot pay their unfunded pensions.
Right. But again, the facts are relevant here. And if it turns out you were not accepting of the notion that the average state employee is getting in the mid-20s, then we should verify what they're actually getting, because we're painting with a broad brush that is really unfair. And by the way, this is what feeds a lot of the anti-public employee animus,
Jim,
is this notion, all of the outliers. And by the way, I condemn the outliers
as
much as you do.
Last week on teachers?
Yeah, I mean, you talked to me about it nonstop.
Okay.
Let's go to Sean in Pittsfield.
What were the best paid teachers in Massachusetts?
Sean in Pittsfield.
95,000.
Sean in Pittsfield, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Sean.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent.
I mean, I just want to bring up one point. You have the opportunity to see what wages are actually put out there by looking at Boston Herald and to look at open checkbooks. The majority of those public service employees are not receiving money in excess of even $50,000, let alone $110,000. So to pigeonhole them with the percentage that actually gets that kind of money is unfair. There are a lot of members out there who do not make enough money to pay their bills on a normal basis. So should the animus be on them because they were fortunate enough to get a pension, which the majority of them do have to work well into their 60s or beyond to actually get the percentage to get a livable wage from their pension?
You know, Jeff, you bring up a great point, which is...
Sean,
if you go on the Boston Herald, you can see the salary
great.
Of every single or almost every single person in the state of Massachusetts. And you're right, a lot of them are not making
in the
big
public
money.
Sector.
Exactly. But I think, Sean, like I said before, I think the biggest problem for me anyway is the age at which you can retire. When most people cannot afford to retire, even at 65,
But as Sean said, and Sean, thanks for the call, the office worker, which makes up the bulk of these people, they're not retiring at 50. They're just not. Some of the public safety jobs are, and I tend to agree with you, is you can vest fully, but then you shouldn't be able to start collecting immediately. And so you should lobby the governor when he's here later this month. Jeff and Sandwich, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about this because of the strike of the school bus drivers, who technically, by the way, are not public employees. They work for this transportation company, but I think you understand the theme. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. A few things. What Marjorie just said about California, this state also is broke. The government required us to start accounting for unfunded non-health care pension liabilities. And we are broke. We are not putting anything towards that bill, which is in the hundreds of billions, if not up to the trillion statewide, and tens of millions for each town. But more to the point.
By the way, it's nowhere near your basic point. I don't know if we're not funding. I know there was a bill, a law that required that we do fund it. It's nowhere near the trillions, but it is a significant amount of money. Go ahead, Jeff.
I think it's about $800 billion for the state.
I don't know what the precise number is, but go ahead.
Right, but more to the point of the schools, I was on a finance committee about 6 years ago, and the school committee tried to say that they would close down the busing. So we actually took the busing out of the school committee budget, but it caused me to look at the transportation contracts in the state. Martha Coakley had actually filed a suit and gotten a settlement for a monopoly in the South Coast. The bus drivers themselves are vastly underpaid compared to the profits that the companies are making.
Well, also, Jeff, and this is a thank you for your call. It's hard to defend these bus drivers on this particular day, but they are part-time. And the problem is when you have to work part-time early in the morning and then in the afternoon, it's pretty hard to fill that in with another part-time job. Barbara in Medford,
I just want to say before we go to Barbara in Medford that I was just looking at the email. It's about 50-50 with many people saying what you're saying, Jim, that we should be more mad at the employers who agree to these exorbitant contracts, and
other people. As a matter of fact, one state worker writing in saying that in his particular case, he has to he's 55 years old with 30 years in, and if he retired now, he'd only get 45%. So he's not in a
well. There's a third option. The third option is not to be mad at the vast majority of these people who are doing great work for very modest salaries.
Well, there's
that's the primary emotion, at least that I feel.
And there are certain wired unions that do really well. Cops, firefighters, and teachers do really well. A lot of the other ones don't do so well, especially, we've talked about this a million times, but social workers. Social workers do one of the hardest jobs in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. They don't get paid very well, and they have very difficult working conditions. So it's certainly not everybody. Let's
Barbara
go to Barbara
in Medford.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I wanted to chime in with the example of my mother, who is a retired teacher. She retired 20 years ago, and her top salary was $44,000 at the time. That was pretty good money. Now it's not worth much. She is terrified that the municipality that she worked for will declare that they can't afford to pay pensions anymore, and she will have no recourse. And I think that that's something most people don't really think about. Is municipalities all over this country are just saying, oops, we can't pay this.
And isn't that, so hold on, isn't that against the law? I can you do that? You're a union expert,
Jim.
I don't know what the answer is. I've never heard of it. I mean, Detroit,
there's
I've heard.
There's cities in California that are declaring bankruptcy,
yeah,
cities and towns.
But I think they have some obligation to the pensions, Barbara. I could be wrong about that. But I think and the federal government, as your mother probably knows, will back up at least private pensions that go south. I'm not
but
sure what the deal
is not a private pensioner.
About public pensions. But
finish up, Barbara.
There definitely have been towns in Rhode Island that I've read about, and their retirees are pretty much out of luck. And what do you do when you're 80-something and you only get $1,000 a month from your retirement, but it goes away? My mother is really scared. And
well, Barbara, I can tell you what the answer is. We heard it here. Be angry at the cops, the firefighters. No, I'm kidding. Barbara, thank you, and good luck to your mother. Tell her we're thinking about her. It's a horror show. And I think Barbara's mother, at least in my estimation, is more the norm than the outliers you're talking about. But by the way, the next time we get return to this topic, or when the governor gets here later this month, we will resolve the issue of what the average state employee
okay,
pension is.
Okay, you can do some research with you now.
No, I actually trust him on this one, frankly. We'll ask him again. Okay. And if it turns out he says $26,000 again, you should feel free to say, Governor, we believe you're cooking the books.
At all that he's intentionally misrepresenting the fact. I just think there are other people who disagree with that and think the numbers have actually gone up and that the low pensions are brought down by part-time workers like the selectmen and the part-time librarians and stuff like that we talked about. Okay, we are moving on, though. Because there's been a big story about pit bulls in the papers over the last few days. We're going to ask you guys up next, if the pit bull's image is changing, do you feel more kindly toward pit bulls or not? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The question's simple. Should the pit bull be feared or loved? It's a debate that animal shelters, animal activists, lawmakers, probably any one of us asks ourselves when we're faced with a pit bull in our neighborhood. In Massachusetts, pit bull adoptions are up, even in the suburbs. I was shocked by the story in yesterday's Globe. That must mean people, I guess, are having a change of heart when it comes to the dog that society once associated with dog fights and branded as a stand-in for handguns. So we want to know, what's your take on the pit bull in October of 2013? Are they love bugs or thugs? Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. For those who listen to us in our former incarnation, I am a rabid, and I mean that as the pun that I just said, anti-pit bull person. And I read the quotes in this fine story that was written in the Globe. Let me give you quickly two of the most powerful arguments by those who say pit bulls are discriminated against. There's an associate or assistant professor or something at Tufts who said, it's how they're treated by the owners. Well, fine, professor. I agree with that. If an owner abuses a dog or doesn't raise it right, it's going to be a wild, dangerous pit bull. When I'm next door with little baby and my baby's head is in the mouth of that pit bull, it's not much consolation to say, well, it isn't the pit bull's fault. It's the irresponsible owner. Then let's go on to the author of Dog Talk. It's a book that's quoted in that story. It's not inherent to the breed, he says. It's a, meaning their the violence or viciousness. It's a function of their size and strength. Exactly. If a pit, if a poodle is raised poorly and bites you on the ankle, it's really not that big a deal. If a dog with the size and strength that the author of Dog Talk suggests bites you anywhere, you're in serious trouble. So I'm almost apoplectic about this. One last piece of fact for those. Boston is one of those communities. We hope to discuss this with the mayor, but again, he couldn't come today because of the school bus driver's strike. Boston, thanks to Rob Consalvo and the mayor, had a pit bull ordinance. It was relatively strong. It was overturned when the governor signed a bill, a law, I guess it was in late 2012, which banned municipalities, cities and towns, from passing breed-specific legislation, meaning you can't discriminate against a pit bull. Whatever ordinance you pass has to apply to all kinds of dogs. I don't get any of it.
And we should add, in late August, the Obama administration responded to this online petition with more than 30,000 signatures requesting that breed-specific dog bans be outlawed at the federal
level. What's the president's position on this, I'm afraid?
Level, that they don't want the... they don't want the ban. They don't think that it's fair to segregate and say that certain kinds of dogs are bad because their feeling is any breed can become dangerous. So the administration is not on the pit bull ban bandwagon.
By the way, maybe they can become dangerous, but again, what's the consequence of a dangerous small dog as opposed to a very powerful dog like a pit bull or a Rottweiler?
Well, on the bad pit bull end of things, there was a story 2 years ago in Boston where the cops had to kill a pit bull after it chased a teen and was poised to attack her. The dog's owner said that the dog just chased the girl because she was running and the dog wanted to play. And listen to this. I missed this one. Andover man stabbed a pit bull to death in the kitchen after the dog attacked his wife and the neighbor who owned the dog. So he attacked his own owner.
Either.
Yeah. And they point out the
problem. Wait, it was their own dog?
Yes. Yes. And then there was the 2009 incident when a pit bull reportedly bit a 12-year-old girl's foot at a school bus stop in Dorchester. But I got to tell you something. I have had a few run-ins with pit bulls because I have a small dog. I've been attacked twice and almost attacked a third time. So it's not been a good run for me with my small dog and the pit bulls. But there was this horrible story about this puppy dog.
You wrote a great column about an incredible rally that was tortured.
It was an awful story. It was so upsetting.
Horrible.
I couldn't even read the stories about this little puppy pit bull. Well, there was a rally for this pit bull in Quincy, which I went to. I was for my column in the Herald, and I was there with my little dog. And there must have been about 50 pit bulls, some of the biggest pit bulls I've ever seen, you know, the size of like German shepherds, huge, big pit bulls.
Any of them speak at the rally or no?
No, but the point is these pit bulls were all very friendly. My dog went up to them. They went up to my dog. So there is truth to the fact that you can raise a pit bull to be a wonderful dog.
What's the relevance of that?
Well, the relevance
is... And when you raise it not to be a wonderful dog, and I'm the next door neighbor, it's no consolation that it's not the dog's fault. It's the owner's fault. I mean, that doesn't do it for
me.
I'm
sorry.
After,
you know, right before the rally, there was people next door to me in Brookline that had a workman come over to do some work at the at the house. And I came out of the house with my little dog once again. And all of a sudden, he was growl, and I see this pit bull like diving over the fence to come after us. And I said to the workman, gee, you got to keep the dog on a leash. He said, well, I just got the dog. He said it was a pit bull rescue.
Oh.
That made me feel very confident that the pit bull rescue next door was going to kill my dog.
Two
and
words.
I looked away for 2 seconds.
Bad owner, don't worry about it. 877-301-897. I have to say, I am as strongly anti-discrimination amongst humans as anybody could be, but the notion that there are actually laws that, as we have in statewide in Massachusetts, that ban cities and towns from breed-specific legislation, as Consalvo said, and I think soon-to-be former city councilor Consalvo, who obviously ran for mayor, and soon-to-be former mayor Tom Menino, is every city and town should be able to decide. And if pit bulls are the problem in Boston, as they say, as Menino and Consalvo say they are, then they should be able to pass regulations that address that problem. It's ridiculous, and it is so PC that it makes me want to...
Michelle just sent us the dog bite fatality chart.
What is it?
Shows that pit bulls are leading in the most fatal dog bites. And by the way, they did some big study in Philadelphia, which came to the same conclusion that the vast majority of dog bites in the city were by pit bulls, Rottweilers, and a combination thereof.
Right. And as we take the calls, we know and we accept that there are going to be those of you who call who say, you've had a pit bull for 10 years, you've gone away for a weekend and left the pit bull in charge of your baby or whatever you're going to whatever ridiculous thing
Peter Pan.
You're going to say. No, I'm serious. We understand that the vast majority of pit bulls are fine, but the potential for horrible outcomes with pit bulls is exponentially greater.
Do you want to ban them?
I think it, for starters, they should not be allowed in cities. I really don't. But I was stunned by the Globe story because, there is a conventional wisdom. I know it's stereotyping that it's tough guys, young guys who want pit bulls as part of their macho deal or even worse, if they're into some nefarious kind of behavior or occupation, they want it for protection. But apparently, if you read the story yesterday in the Globe, there are a lot of suburban middle class families who are just totally pit bull centric. I don't get it, but maybe you'll help us out. Candace, you're in Arlington and you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for the call.
Oh, well, good. I'll open by saying I switched over from BUR to GBH because of you guys.
Oh, we love that, Candace.
Thank you, Candace.
Pit bull as you want,
that's
Candace.
Right.
I can just hang up now, right? That's all I needed to say.
Thank
right.
you for doing that, Candace. Go ahead.
Well, one thing, as a former very, very friendly Doberman owner, I know that they come in all different temperaments. Mm-hmm. But I recently, last year, got a notice from my homeowner's policy that I could not get homeowner's insurance if I owned any one of, 25 or 30 breeds.
Wow.
And, I mean, this included standard poodles. It basically included any dog that was, with the exception of Jack Russells, they were on the list, too. But other than that, they were all medium to large-sized dogs.
Well, one of the things I don't know is, while I'm quite sure the state legislation prohibits what I said it prohibited, cities and towns from doing breed-specific stuff, I don't think it prohibits insurers from deciding that they will issue policies that have breed-specific information.
So what did you do, Candace?
Well, I don't know. I have two little tiny Pomeranians that are...
Okay.
So that wasn't that relevant to me, but I was shocked and appalled, frankly. I was just appalled that they would do this. And just recently, I'm actually a horse person, and I was absolutely shocked to see that the Connecticut appellate court, and I think the Supreme Court upheld the decision, declared horses to be a vicious species.
Based on what?
A single incident of a kid getting bit in the face by a horse that had never bit anybody before.
Wow.
I was just appalled. How do these reverse class actions start? You know, how does one incident declare an entire species as vicious? And if horses are vicious, you know, because they don't have to let us ride them. What does it say about human beings? I mean, why don't we declare all human beings as vicious?
Candace,
them all.
That was a great call.
Candace, thanks. We'll ask the governor when he's in. Thank you, Candace.
Thank you very, very much. Let's go to Jake in Providence. Hi, Jake.
Hello, Jake.
Was that parking lot, that big one down there for them?
Jake, while you're parking, we'll get back to you in a second. We'll get to Jake. Just put him on hold for a minute. Mike, you're in Milford. Hopefully you're not parking. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a pit bull. I'd lived in Framingham for 14 years, and you know, have all the stories that you're saying, that it is the owners that do determine how the dog is going to behave. But I like your idea of they shouldn't be in big cities. They need a lot of exercise, a lot of room to run, and if they don't get it, they just have all this energy. They're a terrier, so they need at least the energy and play. And where can you do that in a city?
Well, that's the thing, Mike. You see a pit bull in the dog park running around, you about have a heart attack. You know?
Don't you? If you see one walking down the street, on a leash, you cross the street.
Well, yeah, I think you do cross it, especially if you have a little dog. But you feel bad for people because we just got an emailer and you hear this too. There's a lot of pit bulls in shelters.
A lot of people are adopting
pit bulls out of shelters because they're trying to be good people and they want to rescue the dogs and give them a good life. And why you're seeing more and more of them in the city, because, you know, if you go to Angel Memorial,
it's
full of pit bulls.
Mike, how many years did you say you owned a pit bull?
14.
Ever an incident or no?
Never with people. She had an incident with a horse she chased once.
Well, that we can live with. Hey, Mike, thank you for your responsible position. We
Speak
appreciate
for yourself.
Your call. What's up?
I don't want any horse attacks either.
By the way, and those people, I am totally sympathetic. Those compassionate souls who were going to these shelters and adopting pit bulls, particularly in the what was the nickname given to the pit bull? Was it the rally?
Oh,
was
Puppy Doe.
Puppy Doe. I mean, I'm totally.
It's awful.
I mean, obviously, you're sympathetic to that, but there have to be reasonable regulations, like there are about anything that's dangerous, of course, except guns, where there are virtually no reasonable. regulations.
Let's go to Ryan in Winchester. What do you think, Ryan?
Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Aaron. I'm actually a dog walker.
Oh.
I work for a company based out of Woburn that serves Winchester and the surrounding area.
Yep.
And it's anecdotal evidence.
That's fine.
We've turned away more dogs that weren't pit bulls than pit bulls. Usually German shepherds, labs that have behavior issues, things like that. And there was actually a study that was done a few years ago. Unfortunately, I can't cite it for you right now. I found it on Google.
That's okay. What did it say?
That found the bite strength, pounds per inch, I think it was, for a few different breeds, including German Shepherds and Rottweilers, was actually stronger than pit bulls. So when you're considering getting a dangerous dog, most people don't think of, German Shepherds, things like that, because they're traditionally used by the police and they have a better image than pit bulls do in the media.
They do. That is absolutely correct. But again, like the data that Marjorie, I know yours is anecdotal and we appreciate it, but as Marjorie said, the research out of both New York, Philadelphia, and research that Mayor Menino and Councillor Consalvo was relying upon, at least in those two jurisdictions, pit bulls are far and away number one. Ryan, how much does it cost to have you walk someone's dog? I'm just curious.
It's $15 for like 45 minutes, and we bring them in a van to a fenced-in dog park where they play with each other.
Oh, that's great. That's actually pretty great. That's great. Ryan, thank you for your expert input. We appreciate it. You could get into that in later life, couldn't you?
I could be. Well, I was thinking about the things I could do to ward off being a bag lady, which I'm worried about all the time. You know,
you said flower arranging.
I don't know if I could do that. But I had the comfortable shoes, I suppose I could be a dog walker.
I could see that
in my old age.
No, you love dogs.
I love dogs.
And they react well to you. It's sort of like Cesar Millan. Yeah,
that's right. The dog whisperer.
Yeah. Do you know that I went to his show in Lynn, by the way, at the Lynn Town Hall or Lynn Auditorium when he came to town?
You did?
Yes. It's a long story.
How was it?
Well, other than the fact that they had just installed $1 million air conditioning system and it was supposed to be turned on that day and it wasn't. Other than that, he was spectacular. Let's go to Charlotte on Cape Cod. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about pit bulls. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, I'm actually a dog walker and a dog sitter for a number of years now, and I have two things to tell you. The first thing is that I do off-lead walks where they're not even on lead in a place where it's like 3 or 4 mile trails.
Uh-huh.
So 90% of the dogs, with the exception of my own dog, are off-lead. So we have people that have every kind of breed, every kind of, and one particular person there has rescued two pit bulls, and these pit bulls were damaged, for the lack of a better word, and ended up being the most amazingly, well-behaved, kind, gentle, dog-loving kind of pit bulls. But she took a lot of time to do this, which brings me to one point. The first point is that it's the owners. It's the people who are training them. It's the people who are giving them the time and the attention and the affection. And I agree with the other man. I've had more problems with German Shepherds, little tiny dogs, and, some kind of...
Akitas, they can be scary.
Yes, well, but they're the ones or the owner who has no idea that their dog is aggressive, which brings me to this dog is just absolutely wonderful. My dog's the best. They're great. And they let them off lead, or they don't. Even if they're on lead, they're still not well behaved. And it's like a dog I inherited from a cousin who's 124-pound golden retriever. He was a year and a half old. He, never got walked, never got out of the crate, never. So I had to start from scratch. Never got in the car. Ultimately, I wanted to let him off lead, but he just wasn't able to be off lead. And when I took him to an aggressive dog trainer, who raised Dobermans and a certain type of shepherd. She said to me her favorite dog was always aggressive and could never be off lead. And she told me things, words I've lived by, and Seamus is never off lead. It's not because he's mean and ugly, because he really isn't.
Charlotte, let me ask you a question, because you know a lot about dogs, obviously. I think a lot of people don't know what to do when these pit bulls, I mean, come towards you, especially when you have small dogs, because they seem to like to pick on small dogs. I mean, what do you do? Stand there? Do you try to hit them with a broom? What do you do?
When I'm out with Seamus, I try to get out early. I mean, when I'm a dog walker and I have everybody else's dogs off lead and I can't even have my own off, you know, it should say something. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
People do not, they just are under the misconception sometimes that their dogs are friendly. And you can say to them, is your dog friendly?
Yeah, but it's a little late when the dog's like leaping in your face is the problem. See that? Hey, Charlotte, thank you for your expertise, too. But, you know, this whole notion, I agree with Charlotte. I agree with all these experts who are in the business. It is a function, for the most part, not completely, of the owner. But I repeat what I said at the beginning. If the owner's irresponsible, who pays the price? The human being in whose mouth, whose body ends up in the mouth of a pit bull.
Well, I remember the time the pit bull came after us and knocked me over, my cousin over, the one that's retired, that's a public employee, and knocked us both over to come after my little dog. The guy who came over, thank God, and rescued us from the pit bull, mm-hmm. the owner, was totally apologetic. He said, my dog is so nice. I don't understand. He's mm-hmm. never done this before. Blah, 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 blah. So it wasn't that
Did
he
Did you feel better after that?
No. I said, what are you doing? I mean, I think that's the thing, too, that not that people treat their dogs badly, but as Charlotte said, they don't realize that they need to be able to tell the dog to stop, and the dog has to stop, or get down, the dog has to get down. They don't teach them that. So when the dog takes off, you know, you're in real trouble. What are you laughing at?
I mean, the
whole, image of
the
me
whole
toppled over.
No, I'm not. I mean, actually, it's sort of scary. The whole concept is so ridiculous. I agree with every one of these people who's on the side of pit bulls as to the issue of the relevance of the owner, even though the little bit of research I've done through the years suggests that it is more in the breed than many would let on. But let's assume they're right and that it's all a function of the owner. That little dog who she said is more vicious in many cases, the little dog can't do the damage. What was she talking about? A golden retriever? How many golden retrievers have killed a human? Has anyone ever done that? A golden retriever ever done that as far as you know?
There was a golden retriever Labrador mix actually who did maul a baby in South
Okay, one.
Carolina.
And I'm not that's hard. It's
but
a horrible
it's very
story.
Unusual. And you occasionally hear a story about a lab, but you know, labs are usually just slobbering all over everybody. You know, and that's what they're droolers. Yeah. It's always a very messy situation.
You know what the other thing is? Marjorie has mentioned this. She doesn't have the courage to mention on the air. She also believes, without substantiation, pit bulls, huge public employee pensions. Most pit – is that – you just – I mean, isn't that your argument against everything?
That's right. I told you, Jim. It's about fear of being a bag later. That's what it's all
Kyra
about.
Kyra in Concord, you are next on Boston Public Radio as we begin to wrap up this installment of our pit bull discussion. Hi, Kyra.
Hi, Jim, and hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
Kira, but that's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just have two words. It's okay. I love your show. Don't
thanks.
Nurture nature, is what it's all about, I think, really, when it comes down to it. But my sister had a Rottweiler, and it was blend.
It was what?
Rottweiler blend.
Mix.
It was a mix, and her name was Daisy, and I'll never forget meeting this dog on Cape Cod, and I'm like, Dana, Daisy, is Daisy nuts? But she was so loving, very, very loving, and she came from a shelter, and my sister was actually concerned, because Rottweilers, as you know, not everyone goes, oh, yes, let's Rottweiler.
Like 0% body fat on Rottweilers.
Yeah, they're scared. They're big biters
Kyra,
as well.
This is a horrible connection, but thank you for the call. So we resolved this issue, don't you think? But the reason we even brought this up again is the end where we began.
Because
and according to Globe
everywhere.
Yesterday, it's not just the city issue anymore.
No,
they're big in the suburbs as well.
They're being adopted, and there's a big push by a lot of the shelters to say that these dogs can be trained. They can be very loving family dogs. And the guy talked about how this pit bull terrier tackled his 9-year-old son and slobbered kisses all over the little boy. and that it's not all these terrible things you hear. But pit bulls, I still find them really scary. And when I see one coming, I cross the street. I try to go out with a suit of armor, and when I take the dog for a walk, just to be on the safe side. Okay, when we come back, it is time for open mic. We're trying to do the interviews. I think we've actually done them all, haven't we, Jim?
With every round one.
Round one. That's right. Of every single one of the candidates running for the Democratic nomination for governor. Up next is State Treasurer Steve Grossman, who is also, of course, running. That conversation is up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It is time for Open Mic. A little history. Charlie Baker used to join us every Tuesday at this time, 1 o'clock on Open Mic. But now that he's jumped into the governor's race, we decided to turn the mic over to the other gubernatorial candidates. And I think today, as Marjorie said, completes round one. So far, we've spoken to Juliette Kayyem, Martha Coakley, Don Berwick, Joe Avalon. And today we are joined by State Treasurer Steve Grossman. Steve, it's great to see you.
Thank you, Jim. Marjorie, nice to be with you.
I had to peek behind the microphone to see you over there.
I know, it's a little difficult here.
But I'll do my best.
Obstructive vision.
Yeah. We were talking before you came in. There's a strike of Boston school bus drivers today, and we were talking about the animus toward public employee unions. I know that before you were in the government, your family business, Mass Envelope, is a private union there, which is different, obviously, than public employee unions. But why do you think there is this growing animus toward public employee unions? It didn't used to be around 30, 40 years ago. Now it's really, you can almost feel it in the air when these school things like these school bus drivers go on strike. Where does it come from?
I think it may have something to do with a perception of imbalance, that somehow people who aren't part of that world feel like their lives have really deteriorated, that their economic lives have deteriorated, their kids are lugging around a lot of college debt, having a lot of trouble paying their mortgages, and they think maybe there's inequitable treatment in some way, shape, or form, pensions, health benefits, et cetera, and that somehow settlements of negotiations go in a direction that they just wouldn't in the private sector be able to take full advantage of. So I think it's a sense of unfairness, imbalance, something of that nature.
You think it's a legit sense of unfairness and imbalance?
Well, I think you have to separate the facts from the fiction.
Yep.
The fact of the matter is that state employees virtually pay for their own pensions. They pay 9% of their first $30,000. They pay 11% over and above that. If you're a teacher, you pay for 11% out of your salary. That essentially funds your own pension. But when people see all these pension benefits and they think that they're not getting the same thing in the private sector, then there is a deep sense of concern that maybe things are out of whack. So I think when you look at the facts don't bear out the emotional response, but people tend to respond emotionally when the world in which they've lived has changed so dramatically. And they're having a hard time getting their arms around it. I mean, we're not coming out of this recession as quickly as we had hoped. People talk about the stock market having been at near record levels. I don't know many working families around the state, and I visit with them all the time, whose lives are back where they were before this punishing recession happened 5 years ago. So I think that is part of it.
Hey, Steve, before we leave this topic, Steve Grossman, Treasurer of the Commonwealth, can you settle a disagreement that Marjorie and I have been having for ages? What's the average pension of a state public employee? Marjorie, do not mouth anything or hand Steve Grossman a note.
I'll say nothing.
What's the average pension?
It's in the mid-20s.
Thank you very much. Okay, so now we have the treasurer and the governor both saying the same thing. Are you accepting of this?
But if we're going to be nitpicking here,
yes.
One thing I think that has been true, though, is that people happily live a long time. So if you work for 20 years for the state, you work for 30 years for the state, you're probably, just do the math, you're not going to be funding 40 or 50 years after that. You know, I think that's one of the difficulties, is it not? We used to all be dead at 60. Thank God that's not true anymore, Steve Grossman.
Thank God. Thank God. I mean, yeah.
As he looks around the room, right, guys.
Just on the one issue of pensions.
Yep.
I oversee the state's pension system.
Yep.
I oversee the state board of retirement. The state pension system is tens of billions of dollars unfunded. That's a serious problem. Fortunately, the investor community looks at us positively, and we've had the highest bond rating in the history of the Commonwealth. But the reality is that we've got to do a lot of things over the next few years between now and 2040 when legally we have to fully fund those pensions. The line item in the state budget has to keep going up, and the legislature can't play fast and loose with that number. They have to increase it every year, and they can't do what they've done in past years. We've got to earn 8% a year in our investments, and we have to implement pension reform. Good news is pension reform was passed a few years ago. It's going to save $5 billion, $3 billion at the state level, $2 billion at the municipal level. Those three things, increasing the line item, the pension in the budget, the $5 billion pension reform, and increasing our investment return, which we've done pretty well over the past few years, that itself will get our pensions fully funded by 2040. That's a good thing. That's the plan we're on.
Hey, Steve Grossman, before we get to your candidacy to be the next governor of Massachusetts, in your former life, you were the chair of the Democratic National Committee under Bill Clinton. What do you make of the Democratic strategy on the shutdown? We're day eight of the shutdown. We're 9 days away from what could be the first default in the history of the United States of America. Barack Obama and the Democrats have said, no negotiations. You want to talk about health care? You want to talk about Medicare and Medicaid? We'll do all those things, just not as part of this. No negotiations, no compromise, clean bills. Where are you on that?
Let's go back to where we started. A president proposed health care reform that would give every American health care and would give those with pre-existing conditions coverage. That bill was ultimately supported by Congress. Both the House and the Senate went to the president's desk, became law. Then it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court validated it, at least in a significant way. And then it went to the American people in the 2012 election, and Barack Obama was reelected by a pretty strong margin. Healthcare was a big piece of that vote. So when a significant change in public policy, healthcare reform, has been validated by all three branches of government, the president, the legislature or the Congress, and the Supreme Court, and the American people have said, we're okay with it, even though there are some problems with it. Yes, some changes may be appropriate. And I can think of some changes I'd make if you and I were negotiating right here. The whole business of small businesses, which the governor has gone back and we haven't had our form, Massachusetts form, of small business benefits included in the bill. This whole business about rating factors, which gets a little complicated. But essentially, we thought when we put a plan in place a couple of years ago that we would be able to lower the cost of health insurance for small businesses by 10 to 15%. That's a big deal. That hasn't happened. So I'd like to see that changed. But fundamentally, when the president said this is an article of faith, it's been validated over the last few years, and I can't negotiate away something that is so important to all Americans that Ted Kennedy worked on back in the 60s.
Yeah, but let's just take away from it. The Republican demand, Steve Grossman, at least as I understand, there are a number of them, is no longer repeal. It's either delay or – one of the demands on the table, at least as of a couple of days ago, was the repeal. Just take one example, the medical device tax. Virtually every Democrat in Massachusetts hates the medical device tax. Ed Markey said it should be repealed. Elizabeth Warren said it should be repealed. With some, they want the money replaced, et cetera. So why isn't the president able to say, listen, this is the one area I'm willing to give, but if I give on this, because even my fellow Democrats think it was a bad idea, if I give, I need to know the shutdown's over and the debt ceiling is raised. Why this immutable principle that I can't negotiate? When he negotiated 2 years ago on the debt ceiling, that led to what, $1 trillion plus in deficit reduction.
So sit down and negotiate some changes in the legislation.
As part of the
Let me finish.
Yeah.
Sit down and negotiate some changes that make good common sense, but don't do it with a gun at the head of the president and of the country. That is not fair. That's not appropriate. You know, I oversee the state's cash. We're in decent shape because we just borrowed $800 million, so we're not going to run out of cash anytime soon. But it's having a devastating effect and will continue to have a devastating effect. If we get beyond October 17th, then it's really going to start to hurt. That's going to hurt the country, our economy, our exports. It's freezing business people. They're not hiring. So don't negotiate with a gun at your head, but let's negotiate common sense things like the medical device tax, which I agree should be repealed.
We're talking with Steve Grossman, who is running for the Democratic nomination for governor. Of course, he is the state treasurer. But if we do get close to that October 17th and we're facing real scary economic stuff, should Obama be more conciliatory than he's been to date?
I think the president always has been a person who's willing to reach out his hand and negotiate. But you've got a relatively small number of people in the Republican coalition who are holding hostage the possibility of getting beyond the shutdown and getting back to the people's business. I mean, I read an editorial just today about how Boehner, John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, has allowed a relatively small group of people in his coalition to hold that hostage. If you put a vote to get back to business up to a majority of the Congress, Democrats and Republicans, without that Tea Party impact, and I'm not going to throw bombs here, I'm simply going to say it is having an impact, then you'd have a majority of the Congress saying, let's get back to business. So I believe fundamentally that the president needs to hold firm here because the people's interest is – this is one of the few times when the people's interest trumps negotiating in a way that will throw Affordable Care Act over the side of the ship, which is what they really want.
Okay, let's come back to Massachusetts and your race for governor. Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say the most recent poll, you're getting crushed by Coakley, and the most recent fundraising, you're crushing Coakley. So we don't have to go into all those details. It's early in the race. However, when you look at where you are on the issues, a liberal-leaning Democrat, and my words, not yours, and Martha Coakley, a liberal-leaning Democrat, is the primary difference between the two of you on what experience you bring to the table? You're primarily a private sector guy with some public service. She's primarily a public sector. Is that the primary difference that should cause people to pick her or you or one of the other people in this race?
Well, I think it's experience and what that experience means in terms of what I'm prepared to focus on.
Like what?
When I become governor.
Like what?
Well, like the economy, like jobs, and like the connection between jobs, the economy, and public education at all levels. I mean, remember, I've spent 35 years of my life running a successful business, growing jobs, creating jobs in the private sector. Took that experience into the treasurer's office, made some commitments to the people of Massachusetts. Said we put the checkbook online, we did it. Said that we put every contract out to bid that I was responsible for, we did it, saving tens of millions of dollars. Brought money back from Europe, Australia, and Asia, the people's money, your money and my money, and put it into small local community banks right here in Massachusetts. Fundamental principle, Massachusetts taxpayers' money, Massachusetts banks, loan to creditworthy Massachusetts companies to create jobs right here. And it's created hundreds of millions of dollars of loans. So my experience is in small business growth and economic development, job creation, and I'm going to continue to work because I do believe the people of this Commonwealth want a governor with proven leadership who's going to leave no one behind. Leaving no one behind, particularly around economic issues, jobs, our economic future, and the kind of public education we need in order to guarantee the workforce of the 21st century. That, to me, is what I'm going to focus on every step of the way in this campaign.
What kind of public education do we need to get ready for the rest of this century?
Well, I can think of a whole series of things. First of all, the governor's right, and I agree with him. We need to clear the waiting list and get the 30,000 kids who are on waiting lists for pre-K off those waiting lists and into programs because, frankly, if those kids aren't reading by the end of the third grade and they fall behind, that's not okay.
Where's the money from? Essentially, his billion-dollar request in new taxes for early education and related topics was almost zeroed out. A little bit of money, $500 million-plus for transportation, not very much for early education. Where do you find the money, Steve Grossman?
Well, first of all, you find the money from new sources of revenue, one of the most important ones that I've been talking about. It was actually passed by the United States Senate, bipartisan majority, almost 20 Republican senators, and that's internet sales taxes. This is a matter of Main Street fairness, by the way. We have 500,000 jobs in this Commonwealth, come from the retail sector. It's $250 million of additional revenue. I would use that money both for transportation and education. Second of all, we've got to incorporate extended learning time in the lives of our children, particularly in high poverty parts of the state. It may be that certain high income communities don't need extended learning time, but we need to incorporate it. The governor's done a little bit of it, but very little of it, and we need to do a lot more of it. Extended learning time, bringing better technology. I've said that I want to make every public school in Massachusetts digital learning ready by 2016. What does that mean? It means we put a tablet, an iPad, in the hands of every high school student, then middle school students, then elementary school students. We use technology with great teachers properly trained in an extended learning time so we bring more music, more dance, more theater, more sports into the lives of children in an extended learning day. They need it desperately.
In Boston, you know that the mayor, Menino, tried to get the extended learning day last year. He didn't get very far. They still have one of the shortest school days in the whole country. So how do you succeed where he failed?
Well, if you talk to Chris Gabrielli, who I spent 2 hours with last week, who's probably more knowledgeable about after-school education and extended learning time than anybody I know. We all know Chris from not only his political campaigns, but his sort of brilliant articulation of bold, energetic reforms.
What's he run? It's called Mass 2020, Massachusetts 2020. Right. Yeah, if you want to look it up. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And it's a very, very fine program. I think we have to sit down together, the business community, parents, educators, political leaders, and say, what do we need to incorporate into public education at every level? I mean, we need to make our vocational technical schools far more appropriate. If we want to create 50,000 new manufacturing jobs in Massachusetts, which I think we can do, then the business community, the vocational technical schools, and the community colleges have to work together. We've got to take that graduation rate in our community colleges, which is now hovering at 17% to 18%, embarrassingly low, and bump it up to the national average of 24%. These things would all matter. Some of them have a price tag. Some of them actually don't have a significant price tag. Fundamentally, I believe we need to grow our way out of this situation we're in and this recession, create more jobs, create more economic growth, create more economic opportunity. And I think I've proven through the Small Business Banking Partnership and through the number of jobs that have been created just in the last 2 years in terms of small business lending that small businesses are the backbone of our economy, but it's got to be widely shared. Because there are too many gateway communities, too many parts of this commonwealth that are in that other community, that other commonwealth. The commonwealth has been left out, left behind, left to fend for itself. So it is ultimately about jobs, creative approaches to job creation. I've done it with my life professionally. I've done it as treasurer, and I'll do it as governor.
So I'm listening to you, and this all sounds terrific. But you know you ran for governor back in 2002, mm-hmm. and you dropped out midway through the season before we got to the final election. How do you get your message out in 2013 so that you can get to put your programs into place? How are you going to turn this around? Jim mentioned it's early, but the poll numbers aren't looking fantastic. How do you change things?
Well, again, I ran in 2002. It's interesting. Somebody asked me the other day, what did you learn from your race in 2002. Yep. I said, I learned how to be a better listener. And in listening to the needs of the people of this Commonwealth, listening to citizens and educators and business people and innovators and people who start new companies, I think I have my finger on the pulse of what they need. Combine that with 35 years of leadership, running a business, bringing progressive values into that business. You know, one of the things that I care deeply about, and it's not being talked about much, but I think it's important, it's a quality of life issue, is that 975,000 people woke up this morning and did not have a single hour of earned sick time. That means when they're sick, they go to work sick because they're afraid of getting fired. It means they send their kids to school sick with 102 temperature because they don't know how to get to work and they're afraid of losing their jobs. This is an article of faith for me. We've had it in our company for 25 years. I was the first business owner to testify in 2006 in the legislature in the Gardner Auditorium. We waited 8 years. This is morally wrong that we don't have it, and it's economically unwise. These are some of the things that I will talk about throughout this campaign. And I think the platform that I have of successful business owner with progressive values who became state treasurer, who made commitments, and who has kept virtually every one of the commitments that he made to the people of this Commonwealth and now wants to take that into the corner office because the governor has a really big toolbox with a lot of really big power tools. And on economic growth, job creation, there are resources there. That's why I'm running for governor.
Can we go from this very high road we've been on to a much lower road where I'm much
Certainly.
More good? Have you seen any of those new $100 bills that came out today?
No, I just saw that we're doing it. I haven't seen one
You don't
yet.
Have them like in your drawers or whatever? Okay, fine. But staying on the political...
No, I only have a 220s, a 10,
can I borrow
a 5,
20
and 2-1.
That's all one I last got. Thing for me. The politics of this race... Doug Rubin's a pretty high-profile political strategist. He did Deval Patrick's for, well, both campaigns, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Kennedy. Used to work. He did your treasurer thing, mm-hmm. did he not?
Right.
He decided in this race, apparently, not to do your campaign and has moved over to Martha Coakley's. What's the backstory here, Steve Grossman?
No real backstory. He did our campaign. I have a good relationship with Doug. He decided to go in a different direction.
Did you want him in this campaign?
We had conversations. Didn't work out. But I've got a terrific team, and that's the most important thing for me. I've got a wonderful team of people, some people you know well, John mm-hmm. Martilla, whom you've known for many, many years.
In the spirit of full disclosure, he used to work for me many years ago when I was doing ballot campaigns. Yes, I know him
and
well.
And John Martilla
Very
still has
guy.
His finger on the pulse, still
he
played
does.
An important role for Ed Markey in his race, successful race to the Senate. People like Dennis Cannon, who ran Paul Tsongas' office, was his chief of staff in the United States Senate. So we've got Michael Hooley, whom you've known for many years, and there is not a better political operative, political player, political strategist in America than Michael Hooley, and he's been sought after by many people, Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, et cetera. Some races won, some races lost, but he was intimately involved in the previous races. So we've got a lot of good ideas. I think the fundamental issue here is not who the advisors are. I think the fundamental issue is who is going to become the governor, who's going to work every single day on the economic challenges, job creation, innovation, public education at every level, who's going to link those up in a way that gives the business people of this Commonwealth, rank-and-file citizens, workers of this Commonwealth, a sense that they're not being left out, left behind, left to fend for themselves. And I hope that my progressive values that I've demonstrated throughout my life in business and as state treasurer, coupled with some really bold, exciting, transformational ideas for the people of this Commonwealth, will give me an opportunity when I'm governor to implement those ideas and keep this state on a track and propel it forward in a way that it deserves.
Last two political questions. As I said, you served as the chair of the Democratic National Committee under Bill Clinton. Is he going to endorse you in this race?
He helped me when I ran for governor in 2002.
Have you asked him yet for his endorsement?
We haven't spoken yet. It's early.
And is Hillary Clinton, in your estimation, either based on your knowledge, which I assume you have, or based on educated, informed speculation, is she running for the presidency the next round?
You know, she hasn't discussed it with me. I saw Hillary when she was in Boston a couple of months ago. I hope she runs for president. If she runs for president, I'll support her. I think she did an extraordinary job as Secretary of State. I think she demonstrated phenomenal leadership. And that's the kind of leadership this country needs. And so I would support Hillary Clinton if she ran for president. And in terms of Bill Clinton, at some point he and I will have a conversation. It's early, Jim. You know, you mentioned earlier the polls. Seems to me I recall a guy named Deval Patrick, who 49 weeks before the primary was way behind, and people pretty
what
much wrote
him
off. I think he won by a pretty wide margin.
Oh, that's Deval Patrick. I'm
weeks
sorry.
Later. I think that's the same guy.
Hey, so Steve Grossman.
I'll be happy to take those odds and continue to be out there. The most important issue in this campaign, the most important thing I can do right now is organize, organize, organize. Inspire and bring those grassroots activists to the table, to the campaign, and give them a sense that the future of this Commonwealth under my leadership can be bright indeed.
Steve, it's great to see you. Treasurer Steve Grossman, we hope we'll see you a lot in the next
Thank
X
you, Jim.
Number of
Thank
months.
Thank you, Marjorie.
Thank you very much for being with us. State Treasurer Steve Grossman is, of course, running for governor. Next Tuesday, we're going to be joined by our new open mic guest, Nancy Kahn, historian based at the Harvard Business School. When we come back, we're going to look at the NFL's checkered response to football's concussion crisis by way of the new Frontline documentary airing tonight, League of Denial. The conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. After watching tonight's Frontline documentary on how the NFL is dealing with football's concussion crisis, you may not be able to watch the game the same way ever again.
33,000 students.
Tom Menino's in the documentary. I'm kidding. We'll get back to that fight in a minute. Okay, here it is. My apologies. Here it comes.
In football, one has to expect that almost every play of every game, and every practice, they're going to be hitting their heads against each other. That's the nature of the game. Those things seem to happen around 1,000 to 1,500 times a year. Each time that happens, it's around 20 G or more. That's the equivalent of driving a car 35 miles per hour into a brick wall, 1,000 to 1,500 times per year.
That was BU neuropsychologist Robert Stern. He's featured in tonight's Frontline documentary, League of Denial, the NFL's Concussion Crisis. Marjorie and I have both watched it. It is spectacular and powerful. Joining us in Studio 3 is one of the producers and the director of League of Denial, Michael Kirk. Michael, it's good to see you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for being here, Michael. So Start with where this documentary started, the story of this football player with the Pittsburgh Steelers, Michael Webster, where this all began. Tell us what happened, who he was and what happened to Michael Webster.
He was the quintessential Pittsburgh Steeler. He was a man of the pit, that incredible piece of real estate that everybody calls the line of scrimmage, where they fight it out day after day. He was the center, so he anchored the offense of a Super Bowl-winning team at a time when Steel City, Pittsburgh, was itself in serious trouble. So he began to represent all the aspirations of all the people of the city. So Mike was tough. In the sense of the film, he was metaphorical, too, because he was the old NFL rock'em sock'em, 3 yards in a cloud of dust kind of a football player. Mike, when he retired, after about 6 or 7 years in 1990, 91, he started to fall apart. By the time he was in his 40s, he was living in his truck, sleeping in the Greyhound bus depot. His marriage of 24 years had fallen apart. His 4 kids would find him there every once in a while, sitting in the truck in the front yard. He was increasingly getting lost. People would leave money and books that he had piled up in the back of the truck on page 52, his uniform number, so that he could remember, as he was losing his mind and becoming mad, where the money was that could allow him to get home or get some food. It was that bad. Tasering himself with an electronic taser to go to sleep at night, in unbelievable pain, and deteriorated in some way that his wife tells us he wasn't the Mike Webster they ever knew. And he began to say things like, I don't know who I am. I'm not who I used to be. When somebody would say, aren't you Mike Webster? He'd say, I used to be.
You know, his son mentions that in the movie and is really powerful, saying the thing that really got to him was when he heard his father say that. And by the way, for people who were not around in the 1970s, it was arguably the greatest football team of all time. And we hate to say that in Patriot land. This guy was a huge rock star of epic proportions in Pittsburgh, the toughest of tough guys. You have in this film, Mike, a television interview that Mike Webster does in his later years. Just listen to Webster, and then we'll get Michael Kirk's reaction. Here it is.
No, I'm just trying to find... Yeah, well, trauma, everybody went through trauma as a kid. I'm not saying I was different than that. I'm just saying... The things we do to one another, okay? Hell, I don't know what I'm saying. I'm just tired and confused right now. That's why I say I can't really, I can't say it the way I want to say it. I could answer this real easy at other times, but right now I'm just tired.
And watching this, when you see this, the sound is powerful. Watching this man's face. So he dies at 50. And why does he become essentially the jumping off piece of what now has become something that's in the consciousness of virtually every American? What happened with Webster?
An obscure medical examiner in the medical examiner's office in Allegheny County in Pittsburgh, a man named Dr. Bennett Amalo, a man walking around with 8 advanced degrees. But inside the medical examiner's office, he was the weekend guy. And this body appears. He knows nothing about football.
I love that, by the way. He's in Pittsburgh.
Yeah,
he knows nothing
great.
About the Steelers. nothing is
well,
great.
He was from Nigeria. Yeah, it's right. From far away.
Nigeria. Okay. And he gets this body to examine. And we don't include it in the film, but in real life, Dr. Amalo believes that the dead talk to him as he's giving their examination and that he is their last doctor. So he's going through the body, finding things, the feet that are cracked and duct taped together, the legs that have bursting varicose veins, all of the things that go wrong with Webster's body as a result of 17 years in the NFL. And he looks at him and says, you know what? He says to himself, I think we ought to fix this brain. Take the brain out, stain it, examine it, preserve it and examine it and look in the future for whatever happened to this guy, because I think something seriously happened that was beyond the heart attack that he had. And he does that, and 3 months later he gets around to looking at the stains one night. And he said he looks at the stains and he thinks, oh, my God, what is this? He had just taken a class at the University of Pittsburgh in brain disease and Alzheimer's. So he's learned to look at slides and he sees something anomalous and he says to himself, oh my God, this looks like something else. For 3 years, he carries this around to different super specialists, getting appointments in Virginia and other places with Alzheimer's specialists. All of them look at it, look at the brain slides and say, and he says, what do you think this guy does for a living? And they look at it and they say, I don't know. And he says, this guy's 50 years old. What do you think he does for a living? And the brain specialists all say, I don't know. And finally, he says, he's a professional football player. And he said, every single one of them looked at him like, oh, my God, this changes everything. And I think Omalu thought the NFL would sign up and say, fabulous, let's go to work. Thank you for finding this. In fact, when he publishes an article in a journal called Neurosurgery, he discovers that the NFL, as he says in the film, will squash you. And they proceed to do that.
And thus the name League of Denial, when they hire scientists and they go into science journals and essentially, my word, not yours, cook the evidence until later years. And then the end of the story, when we can get back to the middle, is people had a lot of mixed feelings about this $750 million settlement that thousands of former players or their wives, families, children settled. On one hand, people thought not enough money, even close. No admission of guilt from the league, which many of them considered an abomination. The flip side, I read the wife of one of the dead players in Sports Illustrated saying, in defense of a lot of these other men, women, they need the money. They can't wait with the uncertainty. They need the money to take care of their husband, who is nothing like he used to be. So that really is temporarily the end of the story, but it's not a very satisfying end, is it?
Well, the first thing that, Jimmy, right to raise this, the dirty secret about all of it is the women who become the widows, the wives, the daughters, that become the caregivers for these players. They married a guy when he was a college football star or a pro football star. They think they're going to live the life, the good life, after he's done. He deteriorates. Maybe he beats them. Maybe he becomes a drug addict. Maybe he becomes an alcoholic. They're broke. And they're caring for a man who's basically a vegetable by the time he's in his 50s.
As you say, a violent, angry person who's
abusing them.
Yeah.
So what happens is that there's no – and what I thought was, well, the NFL, these guys must have amazing retirement packages and medical packages. In fact, none of that is true. And these guys are left – and the women are left caring for a guy. They have no money until they discovered CTE. They didn't know what was wrong with him. Maybe he was just a jerk, right? And until they saw what it was doing to his brain and how it was strangling their brains, they had no idea. So finally, relieved that they have this big disease but worried about how to pay for it, they're ready to take anything the NFL offers them. There were many experts we talked to who said these guys could have gotten $2 billion if they would have held it out, but it would have dragged on for a decade. Most of this cohort of players that we all loved in the 60s and 70s and 80s would be dead. And who knows what their families would have gotten.
Tell us who's – by the way, I'm glad you brought that up, Michael Kirk. Tell us who some of the players are whose names are familiar to us. One of the people – I mean, the former quarterback of the Chicago Bears, obviously, is still alive.
Jim McMahon
having a ton of problems.
Yeah.
Ted Johnson from the Patriots is talking about how he's basically forced to go back into games if he wanted to keep his job. And he is very critical, I know, of Bill Belichick. But it's some of the biggest names in the sport, yes?
Well, absolutely. There's lots of guys that you know, that signed the lawsuit. 4,500 players signed up against this lawsuit. That's one-third of the living retired players in the National Football League. And these are men. These are testosterone-laden men. They're not men who want to admit on a piece of paper that they're suffering from dementia and other problems, or that they might be. But think of the names. Tony Dorsett, right? I mean, this is an amazing guy. Walter Payton. There's lots of people who signed up who, those of us who are football fans, and I count myself in that crowd, I have my own denial associated with watching the game. These are very famous wonderful men who we all enjoyed watching get the crap beat out of them on Sundays, and now they're paying the price, and we've moved on.
We're talking with Michael Kirk, his director and one of the producers of Frontline's documentary League of Denial, which airs tonight. It is a really upsetting, brilliant piece of work, but very, very upsetting. So what would make this right? What do we want to see happen here after, let's hope, millions of people see this documentary and are as upset about it as Jim and I were?
Well, one of the things that a lot of people in the film say absolutely should have happened a long time ago, when the NFL was rolling out 16 bogus research papers about how safe it is to play football, that players could go back in, a concussion is not a long-term problem, is that the NFL own the problem and say, ladies and gentlemen, there is a kind of, we all know about the shoulders and the knees and the orthopedic problems with football, but there has been an invisible and hidden thing happening to players. It's been brought to our attention. We're very worried about it. We don't know the prevalence. We don't know the incidence, but we know that a lot of players who we all loved are killing themselves, and they're doing it in ways now that their brains can go to the brain bank at B. you. So their brain is intact and they can be studied. So folks were worried
shooting
about
themselves
that.
In the chest,
drinking antifreeze.
Yes.
We're worried about the little kids who play peewee football. We're worried about the 5 million people who play high school football and college football and all those little kids. Folks, we as the NFL who love that pipeline and mothers, those of you and fathers who are worried about whether your kid should play football, we're going to do our best to make it safe. But they can't seem, and they never have been able to own it because the marketing machine, as we document, moves on and hasn't and doesn't look back. It thinks about the future, and they do promise that they're researching, but they never quite come to the conclusion that football is dangerous to your head. And if they say, if 45% of the people who view the Super Bowl are women, that if moms who love to gather people on Sunday, their family around to watch that football game, if moms watched this film or knew that the NFL was actually fraudulently, according to many people in our film, keeping this information from players and little kids, maybe that would be the end of football,
yeah, but,
or else football would have to change.
Well, and that's prospective, and I think that'd be a wonderful outcome. But retroactively, while these players, or some of them, got something,
yeah,
the parents who relied upon the misrepresentations, if not the outright lies of the NFL, and thought their kids, well, they can go back in the game or whatever it is. I mean, we saw that, was it peewee football, was it Tentasco or something, where five kids got concussions in one game and, yeah, missed school as a result of it. What recourse do those people have? They have none, right? I mean, they don't have a legal cause of action like the players did. Is that a fair statement?
I just read a story today that said high school football injuries and concussions are the new asbestos cases. There, you're talking about liability issues for public schools all over Massachusetts and every place else.
We should say, by the way, Chris Nowinski has been with us many times.
Yes.
Who was the Harvard wrestler, pardon me, Harvard football player, then pro wrestler, had concussions. And with Dr. Cantor,
who's
behind
Riley,
the Sports Legacy Institute. And Adam Riley.
And Adam Riley's doing a special series this week on concussions to coincide with the film on Emily Rooney's show at 7 o'clock.
Right. And by the way, and the point of reason I brought them is because they're doing a lot of work with these younger kids in schools and legislatures to try to get these tests. You know, the thing that propelled this in the news during the making was the ESPN dropping out of the partnership with you all. They say it, of course, has nothing to do with pressure from the NFL. What's the real scoop here, Michael Kirk?
See Michael's face when you said that.
I don't know anything firsthand other than what the New York Times reported and then a few other media outlets. And I mean, what I know is that the journalists at ESPN, the people we worked with, the Outside the Lines people, were all great. The Fainaroo brothers who work on the film, I think, are as good a reporters as anybody I've worked with, and I've worked with a lot of
one really of them did reporters. The Barry Bonds thing, didn't
exactly.
he?
Yes.
Right,
exactly.
Mark Fainaroo Wada broke the Barry Bonds story with his writing partner. Steve won a Pulitzer Prize in Iraq for his reporting
that's
on
right,
the Washington Post. So they're great, and they stayed with it and because they had a contract to work with us as well. I think the people at ESPN, Peter Keating's in the film, he's an amazing reporter. The people who are real journalists who work there, they say they have 7 Pulitzer Prize winners on their staff now, are, I think, heartbroken about what happened at ESPN because they've been building a reputation to be one thing, only to have something else happen. Who knows whether the NFL actually leaned on it, but it sure feels like it. Maybe it meets the smell test. I don't know. It did for the New York Times. We got to keep our guys. And the film got made, and it really wasn't very different. It wasn't in any way different than when they were in or when they were out. I'm sorry for ESPN and the good people at ESPN that obviously some version of political pressure or internal politics took them off this story. And I don't know what it would be like to work there if I was a serious journalist. I'm glad I don't.
You know, Michael, you've probably thought a lot about this. And this may seem like a ridiculous question, but after putting together this film and learning all about these concussions, can we have football that is less violent?
Many people we talk to, Marjorie, say, no, not the football we know, not the football that became this incredible marketing phenomenon where we all love the fact that the game is so violent, that it's right on a knife's edge between beauty and ballet and athleticism and real bone-crunching danger,
yeah,
especially the play, you know, in the deep with the DBs, the defensive backs, the quarterbacks, the wide receivers who get completely mauled and nailed, but
not
still make the catch.
Loves that. I hate that.
Well,
part
I understand, but
that was a huge part of the draw. Mark.
It is
I
a
guess
huge
maybe
part
it's a male female thing or something. When you hear that smack, you're like, oh God.
Well, I know. I'm not sure it's a male female thing. That may just be my own personal flaw that I like it. But at the same time, it is, you know, you talk about, so, okay, what can they do?
Yeah, what can they do?
Commissioner Goodell has, you know, said you can't hit above the chest with your helmet. You can't. The helmet, by the way, is the weapon in the game now. It always has been ever since they started wearing plastic, hard plastic helmets. It's not to protect your head only for, you know, a major contusion, but a skull fracture, but it doesn't protect your brain basically in any way. So what it really is a weapon. Hit them in the middle of the chest and raise your up, get them in the chin, get the brain going, get them a little loopy and knock them down. That's the technique, right, that has been football. Do you slow down the kickoffs? They've tried a little bit of that. But the primary problem is what's happening in the line. That's where it's happening to little kids. That's where it's happening to high school kids. It's the G-force on that distance across the ball in the line of scrimmage, getting hit in the head 50 times a practice, 50, 60 times in a game, those side head hits, the slaps, the knockdowns. Your brain is rattling around inside there, and the rotational forces are taking you over, especially if you're a little kid under 14 and your neck is not big enough to support your head, and your brain is rotating inside that skull. So can you eliminate line play? Well, you could have everybody stand up. I've had people tell me, take the helmet off, take the face mask off. Now you've got a kind of rugby football. But will people tune in on Sundays to watch a game where every guy is sort of face-to-face and it's a little wrestling match there at the front? Nobody's doing big kickoffs. Nobody's doing big punts, big punt returns. Those central sort of elements of the game are taken out. One of the options is a live test where you could, you know, have a litmus test on your tongue and find out whether you have potential for CTE or other kinds of brain damage. That's a few years out. Is there any technological thing you can do with a helmet? People tell us no, although people are selling that as a business. Is there any way to know that somebody's had a bad enough concussion? Maybe they can test that. But is it enough to really, I mean, are we really going to get there? And if we get there, who really plays football? It's a certain class of people who are willing to go out and get hurt for $1 million here and there. It's boxing in 1960, 1970, when it was a huge sport in the 50s. Then Emil Griffith, Benny Kidd Perrette have a fight. One of them dies on national television on Friday night. And that kind of did it for boxing, other than Mike Tyson biting off Evander Holyfield's ear, which I suppose sent it to another place. But football, fading, not immediately, maybe not ever. They're very good, these guys. They make $10 billion a year. They're real good.
Well, my view has changed comes from the people in the stands and the people watching television. And if you watch tonight at 9 o'clock, my sense is you're going to want to weigh in. Michael Kirk, the film is brilliant, and thanks for sharing your time with us.
Thank you very much,
and congratulations. It is very, very powerful and very, very upsetting. I should mention again, our focus on concussions continues all week on WGBH radio, TV, and online tonight at 7 WGBH. Channel 2's Greater Boston, Adam Riley, again examines innovative ways to detect concussions sooner. When we come back, we have some good news for you, maybe not so good for your local grocer or farmer's market, but that's where you can forage for your own, on your own, for cherries, artichokes, mushrooms, and more, up next on 89.7 WGBH. Okay, welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Good news, there is such a thing as a free lunch and maybe even a free dinner. Here with me in Studio 3 to explain all the great, safe, edible food that we can forage is Edgar B. Hurwitz III and environmentalist Russ Cohen. Thank you guys both for being here today. So I'm so excited about this. I saw Edgar's piece and I saw you guys out there foraging together.
It's true.
You know, the only thing I ever foraged my whole life was maybe a blueberry off a tree. I had no idea all this stuff was available. So tell us about what you guys did together.
Well, I can sort of give you the background. Basically, we kind of got interested in this up in the newsroom. We were talking about, everybody sort of talks about apple picking around this time, yep, of year, you know what I mean? And, we got to talking, well, there are things other than apples that you could pick. So we started digging around looking for an expert who might be able to, show and tell us a little bit about this. And and Russ Cohen here, his name comes to the top of the list. You do a little search around here. He is the guy, or at least one of, if not the guy around here, who is the foraging expert. So basically, we contacted Russ, and Russ took me out, and we brought some cameras with us, and we just walked around the Alan Cox Reservation, and he blew my mind. Is basically what happened. We put a great thing together on the on our website, wgbhnews.org.
It's
and,
great.
And I'll let Russ kind of take it from here.
And you brought us presents.
Foraging is all about the visceral, tangible aspects, uh-huh, of connecting to the outdoors through your taste buds. And so I know you had a great bird watcher on yesterday.
We did. It was wonderful.
And foraging is actually easier than birding because you don't have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. You don't get a crick in your neck from staring up into the canopy all the time. And you don't even
need... get to eat what you see.
That's true.
So anyway, there's edible wild plants all over the place, even in downtown Boston where my office is. I can go foraging on my lunch hour. But up in the North Shore where we went, Edgar and I, and also but out in central Mass, western Mass, up in northern New England, there's edible wild plants all over the place. So if you like being outdoors, knowing what you can nibble on just makes it even more fun.
Wait a minute. What can you eat in downtown Boston, Russ?
Well, for example, beech plums, one of the plants we covered in the show. DCR planted beech plums in a park in Charlestown, and that's
really?
Right across the river from my office. And so on my lunch hour, I'll walk over there and just nibble on the beech plums.
If anybody wants to call in for your foraging questions, where
yes,
the best places to go and how you tell what's good and bad, what you can eat and what you can't, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970 is the number. So right in front of me, I had this huge basket. I thought these looked a little bit like...
tennis balls.
Yeah.
I mean, they look
sort
like
of
used
yellow
tennis
and
balls,
green.
Right?
Yeah, those
but
are in fact,
are they?
Those are black walnuts, and
black
those are
walnuts
in season right now, and they... the husk looks like these old green tennis balls.
Yeah.
And you have
smell
to get...
Smell the husk, though.
Right. It's got
ooh,
a neat,
smells
spicy
like limes,
smell.
Kind of a little
it's
bit.
Sort of like church incense to me.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Really fragrant. Really
were you
nice.
An altar boy? Is that how you know that?
Oh, yeah.
It does sort of smell like incense. You're right.
So, well, this outer part isn't edible. It's the inner part. So you have to get the outer part off. And then the inner part, I have it in a jar, actually, right in that basket there. So you can try what the black walnuts taste like once they're out of the shell.
Okay. Should I try one?
Wait,
yes,
try
please.
These, Marjorie. So when we were out, Russ has explained to me that, that you got to kind of take this out of the shell. And he literally puts it down on the ground and he stomps on it really, really hard. And, the shell's kind of smushy. And then you sort of pull out from inside the shell what definitely just looks like a
actually,
nut. And then you crack the outside of the nut. And yeah.
That's
it's
delicious.
Really good, right?
So they look like tennis balls mm-hmm. and inside are these sort of walnuts that are really delicious and good.
Right. It's a native species to New England. And you see the flavor is different from a standard store-bought walnut. So
yeah, very different. There's a different something
right.
to it.
So there's a little bit of effort to get the outer part off. But mm-hmm. Once you do that and you crack them open, and you need to use a hammer, by the way. You don't want to use
you
a conventional nut cracker.
Well, you can use your foot to
really
get
strong.
This husk off, but then you need, as Russ says, a hammer to get the shell around the nut, which is inside of the husk.
Okay, that's what these are. These are the walnuts. Now, there we have things that look like nuts.
Pass this to her.
We're going to go with this first,
okay.
Marjorie. Check that out.
So these
oh my
are
goodness.
Wild berries that are in season right now, and these are called autumn olives. It's an invasive species. It grows all over Massachusetts because before we knew that the plant was invasive, the state planted many of these along highways. And now they're in season. There's thousands of plants with huge clusters of berries. And so they're the berries you're looking at. They're pea-sized. You can eat them, but I have something even nicer right there, which is a fruit leather that I make from the autumn olives. I just puree the fruit and dehydrate it.
So it looks like a fruit roll-up kind of thing, a little
right.
fruit leather.
Right.
What we're looking at here.
It does. Those things kids love. What do they call those things that kids love?
Fruit leather.
Fruit leather. It does taste like just like fruit leather, but less sweet, less saccharine sweet. These look like little tiny grapes with little stars on them.
They do. Now, interesting, one of the things that I learned when we were out, and Russ, you just mentioned it here, the idea of the difference between a native species and an invasive species, and that
right.
sort of that differentiates how you're going to forage. I mean, one of the things that you sort of explained to me is, you know, how do you forage responsibly, right? You don't want to kind of go out into nature. To your point, we're not the only animals that are going to eat this, right? So, you know, these plants, these edible plants are a part of an ecosystem. And you as a person don't want to go and just ravage a tree and take everything
off
it. You
don't want to harvest so much right? that you upset the ecological balance. Yes,
right.
That's important for native species. So I'm always checking to make sure there's a lot of them out before I pick and a lot left over after I'm done as a way of making sure the plants are able to continue to thrive in the location I'm finding them. But often, like in the case of black walnuts and hickory nuts, the plants produce a lot of those because it's their seed dispersal mechanism. And so you harvest some, it's not that big a deal at all. So typically, like black walnuts will be falling off the tree for a 3 to 4 week period. The squirrels and chipmunks are there constantly gathering all they can. You're there for one day. So you get your share one day, and they have it the rest of the time. So it works out pretty well.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking with Edgar B. Hoyt III, who did a great piece on foraging with our guest here, Russ Cohen, who's a professional environmentalist and wild foods enthusiast. So do people – I mean, you do this, Russ.
Yes.
But I mean, is there a group of people that kind of like – hang around in Plum Island, which I didn't know until today was named after the beach,
that, right?
The beach plums.
The beach plum.
Yeah, that hang around Plum Island or go down to Charlestown and or they forage out where you guys were foraging.
Right, well,
a hobby on the weekends kind of deal?
Of course, you know, this was an activity that Native Americans depended upon for a substantial part of the food that they ate. And the colonists, when they came over, certainly did a lot of it. And as we became a more affluent society, we became more and more disconnected from nature and we got used to the fact of just going to the supermarket and buying things wrapped in plastic, and we kind of forgot where food comes from. And we also forgot about the seasonality of foods. Like a lot of the things I'm showing you today are in season right now. 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks from now, they'd be out of season. And that's just the way nature is. And I look at these as an opportunity to celebrate nature and celebrate each thing as it comes into season. So these are not like Hallmark card invented holidays. These are actual phenological events on the calendar.
That's right.
Where you get to appreciate things as they come in, and you know when something comes out, then the next thing's coming
in. How much that you forage do you actually eat?
I do a lot of picking and eating wild food, but at the very most, it's probably 10% of my diet. So I have a relatively conventional diet. I'm going to supermarkets and restaurants, and I'm going to farm stands and farmers markets, and I grow fruits and vegetables at home. But in addition to all that, there's probably at least 80 different species of wild plants and mushrooms that I'm eating as well.
And one last thing before we get to the calls. You guys mentioned that there's a warning signal if you are eating something that is probably not good for you.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most interesting reactions that I had, and Russ was explaining to me that it's not all that uncommon, but it's really funny because, you know, as Russ was saying, we sort of developed as a society where we're so used to going to a grocery store and buying something wrapped in plastic that somehow seems safer. You know, I'm with Russ, who's an expert. We're out in the wilds, and, you know, he kind of identifies something, and I trust him because he's an expert, but we're just plucking something off the tree, and you know, he's popping it in his mouth and he's explaining to me that this one's safe to pop into my mouth. And immediately I kind of have this hesitation, which is like, oh, shouldn't somebody test this or shouldn't the FDA come in and look at this?
You know, and I frequently hear when people go out in the woods and they see a berry and they say, oh, gee, I don't know if that's the thing I remember from Russ's walk or not. And they'll chicken out and they don't eat it. I think that's sensible behavior. To just feel quite confident that what you're eating is in fact the thing that is in fact edible. Fortunately, in this region, almost all the poisonous plants that grow around here taste horrible. And so,
really?
Right. So I encourage people not to eat stuff that tastes bad. It doesn't mean that every plant's going to be delicious straight from the bush or the vine or whatever. But if you prepare it according to instructions and you got a big steaming plate of it in front of you and you take a bite and it doesn't taste good, I wouldn't override that danger signal your taste buds might be giving you. You might have made a mistake in identification.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, one of the things I think that you said to me, Russ, which I think was really great, is that, you know, it's about building confidence in doing this on some level.
That's right.
And that, like, you know, if somebody tries something once and then isn't ready the next time or whatever, or they go foraging once and then the next time they go back to the grocery store, you don't see this as a failure. It's about sort of exposing people. And as they get confident or as they feel safe to, or as they learn about it, I mean, you pointed out as well, this has been crowdsourced for eons, right? You know, the testing has been done on this stuff, and if you identify it right, you're pretty safe.
Right, and there are easier to recognize plants and harder to recognize plants. There's plants that are edible that most people already know, like dandelions. And so you can stick with the plants that you are confident in. You don't need to push the envelope before your own comfort level.
877-301-8970. Russ, can you take a couple calls here? We've got Jay on the line from Jamaica Plain. Hi, Jay. Thanks for calling.
Hi. This is a really interesting topic. I like noticing when I walk in nature or even in the city, things that are growing that are edible. And my question has to do with legality and etiquette. I mean, I'm not going to go into some guy's yard if there's an apple tree, but if things growing over the fence, that seems more legitimate. And what if you're in, like, you know, there are these nature areas around Brookline and Newton where I've seen apples and walnuts and chestnuts. Like, how do you
know if
it's okay? And
yeah.
That's
a great question. And I always ask, I'll knock on the door of a house if I see, you know, some edible nuts in the yard. And let's take, for example, the black walnuts I brought into the studio today. Typically, when I see those in somebody's yard, I knock on the door and I ask, can I pick some of your black walnuts? And the typical response is, wait a minute, let me get my wheelbarrow and fill it up for you. Because these, the outside of these husks are, you know, they're a bit messy. And so often people are eager to get them off their property. And I've almost never been turned down by somebody that I just asked politely, would they mind if I foraged? And usually people are happy to see that happen. I'm happy to tell you that the place where we filmed the foraging walk, the Essex County Greenbelt Association owned property, they allow foraging as a permitted activity on all their properties that are open to the public, which is dozens of properties covering hundreds of acres. And if you just go to ecga.org, you can pull up their property and trail maps and just go there and start nibbling.
Jay, I hope that was a good answer to your question. That is the big basket of black walnuts over there, correct? You must have.
Actually, this basket
you
got to
try these.
Okay. Is the shagbark hickory nut. This is my favorite.
Oh, the hickory nut.
Right.
Oh, no, this is going to blow your mind.
This is
my favorite of the more than 150 species of edible wild plants that you can find in this region. And they're in season right now. I gathered some this morning.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that the best nut you've
ever
had?
Right.
How do you describe them?
I say that they taste like walnuts have been lightly sprayed with maple syrup.
Right. And
they do.
Right.
Okay. What do those look? Describe those on the outside, so people will know if they see them.
Okay. Sure. These are in green, four-parted husks is the outside part, and it comes off really easily
as opposed to
the black walnut. See, it comes right off like that, and then inside is the shell.
Yeah.
And then I just use a hammer to crack these open, and so what you ate is just. Some hickory nuts that have been lightly toasted in the toaster oven. So you can see that they're really good just plain, but I made for you a couple different kinds of cookie recipes using hickory nuts.
So.
That's right. We have cookies in the studio.
This is fantastic.
Ladies and gentlemen, cookies in the studio.
So wait a minute. So if someone just sees a hickory nuts on the ground off a tree, they can just take them home and crack them open.
Yes. Well, the story with hickory nuts is often the trees grow right along the roadside, and the nuts just pile up right along the road, so you didn't have to knock on anybody's door or anything. Just, you know, watch out for the traffic, but just standing on the pavement, you can gather hundreds of nuts that way.
These cookies
are really
good.
I shouldn't be eating on the air. I'm sorry. I apologize in advance. Let's go to Astrid from Malden. What do you think, Astrid?
So the first thing that I was going to, beyond my point that I was going to make before, is that one, you get incredible trace elements from things that are just growing in your lawn. I mean, most of the food that we get is so highly processed and it is fed. And so you're getting sort of, you know, basic nutrition. But things like purslane and goose tongues and dandelion greens that you get from your lawn have incredible trace elements that you're just not going to get in your everyday diet. But the thing that I called about was black walnuts. If you are going to husk them, and I actually have a black walnut, I'm so lucky to have a black walnut tree in my yard, but you have to wear gloves. I processed a bunch of walnuts last year, and I had actually lobstering gloves, and the husks are a bit caustic, and they actually ate through. Now I have like about 6 gallons of husks, sea husked walnuts. They ate through the gloves, and my hands were stained with black walnut stain for about a week and a half.
Right. Well, that's That's all true. That happens to me every year, and I don't mind it at all. And, you know, people know who I am, so they see my hands are stained brown. They figure I've been out
foraging.
They're
like, the black walnuts are in season. Russ's hands are
right,
brown.
Right. So the way to avoid that is if you let the husks begin to rot a little bit on the outside. They're sort of green when they're really fresh, and that's when they stain the worst. If you let them get soft and yellowish brown, then they come off a lot easier and they stain a lot less, and there's a lot and I agree, for people that don't want their hands to be stained brown, yes, wear gloves, taking the husks off black walnuts.
Russ Cohn, we only have about a minute left. Where can people go to get more information about foraging?
Well, they could go to my webpage. I don't have a domain name, but if they just Google me, just Google
Russ Cohn.
Russ Cohn.
Okay.
They'll go straight to my webpage.
And also, if they check out the piece that we did on WGBHnews.org, there's links to Russ. There's links to the Essex Greenbelt Association where Russ was talking about. So that's mm-hmm. another place people can go for information.
And what do you think of the most? I mean, I think you mentioned the hickory nuts. Are they the most delicious thing that you've eaten, or is there another favorite you'd like to tell everybody about? The cookies are unbelievable, by the
right,
way.
Right. They're my favorite. And because they're in season right now, that's foremost on my mind. But in the spring, it might be stinging nettle. In the summer, it might be, you know, the blackberries or wineberries or black raspberries. So there's always something good to look for any time of year.
And where's your favorite place to go do the foraging?
It really depends what's in season when. So uh-huh. right now, hickory nuts are great on the North Shore, out in Worcester County, Middlesex County. So any of those places should be really promising. Just check the roadsides.
Okay, and the cookies you just gave me, what are they made from, please?
They're made from shagbark hickory nuts.
Oh, they're absolutely
beaming.
Delicious.
You're beaming, Margie.
I am beaming.
You're glowing.
Well, I mean, how much fun is this to go out and being out in nature and stuff? Edgar B. Hurwitz III runs the Curiosity Desk, not the Curiosity Shop, as I call it.
Whatever
the other day.
You call it is fine.
Russ Cohn is an environmentalist. Thank you both for being here
You're most welcome.
And thanks to you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with the Boston Globe's editor, Brian McGroy. We'll also look at what we've learned 1 year after Hurricane Sandy. Thank you for listening again. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan, and Jim Brown is not here, but he'll be back tomorrow. Thank you guys again, and thanks for listening.